not happy. This is December 7th, 2000. I'm Elizabeth Van Allen. I'm here today with Dr. Stephen Bearing. Dr. Bearing, I thought we'd start talking about your background. I know you were born in Germany and did not come to the United States until 1948. I'd like you to tell me a little bit about your childhood, your struggles to get an education, and what motivated you to go into medicine.
Well, I was born into a German merchant family, really an international family with people all over the globe, which is still the case, interestingly enough. And while born in Berlin, Germany, I grew up in Hamburg, and that is one of the great cities of the world. I was just over there a week ago, and 2.5 million people, vibrant, multilingual, engaged in international commerce and business and industry, and it was exciting then, it's exciting now. The family led a very normal life until the Second World War came along, and that tore everything apart in Europe, including our family. We were bombed out during the big air raids on Hamburg and lost everything, including each other. My father was lost for a number of years, and my mother and brother and I eventually wound up in southern Germany and spent 2.5 years on a farm doing farm labor. I learned to milk a cow and things like that, which was all part of my upbringing. But I also missed education. I missed several years of schooling. So that when the war was over and we were eventually reunited and came back to Hamburg, I had a very difficult time catching up because the German system of education is very stylized and very regimented, and they wouldn't let me back into school. You've missed so much school, you can learn a trade. And my mother tutored me, and I should add I grew up in French and German and English, and she was a splendid teacher. So I had a bit of homeschooling in order to pass the examinations to get back into the regular cycle. And I got that done, and then, of course, the place was just totally torn apart economically and physically and every other way. And my American family, on both sides, really, my father's family in North Dakota went there under the Lincoln Homestead Act provisions, and my mother's family had been in New York and Boston and Pittsburgh. They collaborated with the International Red Cross to get us to the United States, which could not be done immediately post-war. So we wound up spending several years in London with other members of the family. And again, I missed a lot of school. And however, I had some extraordinary experiences, like working for a time for BBC Radio living with a cousin who was a Shakespearean actor, and having occasion to, at dinner, meet one of his students, whose name was Larry Oliver, later known as Sir Laurence Olivier. Wow. he said, if I can ever be half the Shakespearean actor your cousin is, I would be really happy. And of course, my cousin responded, I want all my students to eclipse their teacher and be better than I am. And indeed, Olivier did that. Unfortunately, Fred Falk, my cousin, died long before he could see what greatness Olivier achieved, and he died in a dramatic way on the stage playing Shylock from a brain hemorrhage.
Wow.
And in fact, his biography is entitled Shylock for the Summer, because he was in the summer Shakespeare festivals at that time. Eminent, absolutely a compelling person and a very splendid actor. Eventually then, in 1948, we came to the United States, first to New York, then to Boston, and then to Pittsburgh. And it was here I really began to pick up the pieces. I had hoped to become a physician because of the experiences during the war that turned me against being a merchant or a business person. And I thought that I could make a difference by taking care of sick people. And I wanted to do this in a special way. I wanted to become an academic physician, a professor. And eventually attended the University of Pittsburgh, both for my undergraduate as well as my medical work, and it all turned out exactly as I had hoped at that point. Interrupted, albeit by having been drafted, and I spent altogether 12 years in the Air Force of our country as a medical physician and a flight surgeon. And again, fate intervened, and I had some extraordinary experiences. I was one of the first several doctors for our space program, got to know all of our astronauts, and I still know almost all of them, particularly as the story then unwound later. It turns out that many of the early astronauts were Purdue graduates, and when I got to Purdue University, of course, I discovered that. And we had a number of reunions, one just recently, the 30th anniversary of the first man on the moon, and Neil Armstrong and I invited all the others to be there. And it was fascinating to see that the younger astronauts had not met the older ones, so that David Wolf of Indianapolis here, who's got an engineering degree from Purdue and an MD degree mm-hmm. from IU, had never had occasion to rub shoulders with Neil Armstrong and Gene Cernan and asked if I could help him get an autograph. And by the same token, the pioneers among the astronauts were fascinated about having to learn Russian, which David Wolf had to do in order to be on Space Station Mir. And he and Shannon Lucid, of course, are the two human beings who spent more time in space than anybody of our American astronaut corps. And so the evening never quit. They wanted to hear each other's story, and he did get his autograph. It was just an extraordinary experience to have that. You asked why medicine, and I guess the reason in the main was that I was so morally outraged and personally aggrieved by the suffering and the personal tragedies that I witnessed during the Second World War that I wanted to not just stand by and talk about it, but I wanted to roll up my sleeves and do something about it. And I thought that being in medicine and teaching medicine in particular would be the best way for me to do that. And I'm happy to say that that is exactly how it eventuated.
You were separated from your father. How did that happen, and how did you find each other again?
Well, because everything was destroyed, he happened to be on a business trip back to Berlin, the place of my birth, and we were evacuated along with others and taken out of the burning city. Hamburg was just absolutely leveled. It was a four-day air raid, and there was nothing left, and people could not be there. So he didn't know where we had gone or whether we had survived, and we didn't know what had happened to him. And so it wasn't until the Red Cross got involved after the war that we were located and brought back together.
And you were sent out to do farm work. Where was that?
Yeah, that was in near Nuremberg, south of Nuremberg, a very beautiful part of southern Germany.
You went to medical school at the University of Pittsburgh. What was your medical experience like, and how has medical education changed through the years?
Well, in those days, 40-some years ago now, medical education was very similar around the country. It was very similar to what we did here at the time. And it was very lockstep. The curriculum was almost interchangeable from one school to the next in the United States. And the first year was anatomy and physiology and pharmacology, and the next year was physical diagnosis and pathology. Then the third year there were clinical rotations, and the fourth year there were more clinical rotations. So if you were pretty good at what you'd been doing up to then, you might have a junior internship, which was happily what I got to do. And then there was an internship. We don't do that any longer in those words. We now have a residency that begins after the MD has been earned. And the rotating internship, which most of us by state statute, at least in Pennsylvania, were obliged to take, was then an in-depth experience of the major clinical specialties, because the notion was that people would go and do general practice. It was a subset of the medical graduating class who would actually go into specialties and take further training. People left with their MD in hand and their internship behind them, and they started to work. We did have residencies, of course, when I finished, and I interviewed for a number of them around the nation, and wound up, along with others, being told you've been deferred long enough, and so I joined the Air Force, and wound up at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and eventually to the Wolfert Hall Air Force Medical Center, where I spent 10 years, and then I came to Indiana.
You mentioned the space program. What were your most significant experiences serving as a doctor in the armed forces?
Well, I rose to become head of medicine for the Air Force's Specialty Referral Hospital in San Antonio. And so consultation on a worldwide basis.
Shoot. See, Nancy forgot to turn.
Take it up with that question again.
Ask me again. Hit me again.
What were your most significant experiences in the Air Force? You've already mentioned the space program, but what else did you find very noteworthy?
Well, getting to know the astronauts, of course, was even then, before we knew how significant that would be, was a personal high. Being able to start a residency in internal medicine, which became a large and very productive and successful undertaking. Managing a cancer chemotherapy study group on behalf of the National Institutes of Health, working with the Southwest Foundation for Medical Research, doing research on space-related issues with the astronaut group. The friends I made, these were very significant, and I probably would have stayed for a career if I had not been asked to go to Washington, D.C. and become a desk pilot. And I didn't want to do that. I was a flight surgeon as well, and that was very exciting and interesting to fly around the world and to be involved in operational concerns for the Air Force. John Hickam, who features large in Indiana medicine, was an Air Force brat. His father was the gentleman for whom Hickam Field in Hawaii is named.
Okay.
And he happened to be one of our consultants in the Air Force, and he and I instantly became friends and remained the best of friends. And he said to me one day when he visited in Texas, when you ever get to the point where you want to hang up the blue suit, before you go anywhere else, please call me at Indiana. We'd love to continue our professional association, have you join the staff of the IU Medical School. And that actually occurred in 1966, and then I couldn't leave just then because of the Vietnam War and the problems that we had to deal with there. But in December of 68, I came, and Herman Wells signed my letter of appointment, and he too became a dear friend and patient, and I cried like a baby when I went to his funeral here earlier this year. What a grand gentleman he was. And the same problem with John Hickam, who died of ruptured cerebral aneurysm while we were together at a meeting in Chicago. And giants among men, extraordinary human beings, lovely people. And I guess as I look back over my modest career, the people that I have been able to encounter and work with have really been the most significant experiences.
You've already mentioned Wells and Hickam. Who besides those two influenced you in your career, and how?
Well, in the medical career, and I could go before that even in college and in Europe, but let's stick with medicine. When I was a student at the University of Pittsburgh, there were some incredible medical pioneers and giants at that private university who worked together in across all the disciplines. And I was impressed by their breadth of knowledge and their grasp of issues and their willingness to work together, surgeons with internists, psychiatrists, pediatricians, and so on. And I recall with great fondness Lucian Gregg in medicine and Jack Myers in medicine, Sam Harbison in surgery, Paul McLean in pharmacology, C.H. William Rui in physiology, and I could go on. It's a pantheon of greats. Perhaps one that you would know right away was a pediatrician of some note, Ben Spock, was mm-hmm. one of my teachers, and I actually spent a year with him on a special project with the families of children with ulcerative colitis. And to have that kind of experience as a medical student was really special. I should mention Tryphena Humphrey, who was one of the most famous neurologists and neuroanatomists of her day, and I was privileged to work with her and with Davenport Hooker. I was, in fact, the Hooker scholar when I was in medical school. The Davenport Hooker story is long and extraordinary. He was a master anatomist and an MD as well as a PhD, who had come from Yale University, and was simply determinative in terms of what he represented, not just as a teacher, but as a role model. And so was Tryphena, and I was privileged to do research with both of them. At the end of the first year, as a little anecdote on me, he had told all of us that we had done poorly in mid-year, 86 of us, and we better give up our Christmas vacations and go back to the lab and work on anatomy, histology, embryology, and so on. And at the end of the year, I had 97% in those courses, and that was posted on the wall with your social security number. And so since I was the Hooker scholar, my colleagues in the class said, why don't you go see him and try to get an explanation for this draconian judgment that we had at Christmas time, and now we've all done very well. And so I did, and he listened very kindly and carefully, and at the end of that he said, I noticed that you only got a 97 and not 100%. And if you're going to be a really good doctor, you're going to have to be 100% sure of what you tell the nurse to administer in the way of medication, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, get out of here and study. Many, many years later, he was dying of a malignancy, and his wife asked if I would come and consult on his case. And there was really nothing else that I could offer, but I couldn't help myself. Before I left, I said, Dr. Hooker, I could never call him by his first name, said, you amaze me by calling on someone who was only 97% sure. And he said, oh, you remembered that. He said, well, you were the best we ever had.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And so he never made it to 100% himself. But, I just can't tell you what a significant influence all of these people have had on my life. And then here at the, there were many in that segment of my military medical career, too. The ones here at the medical center, of course, John Hickam stands out as the most influential. Glenn Irwin, who is fortunately still with us, now 80 years old, one of the kindest and most wonderful and sensitive and caring individuals, a great doctor, really a great doctor, wonderful teacher, and a wonderful dean and mm-hmm. chancellor mm-hmm. at this campus, and will always admire him. Had a great influence on my subsequent career when I became dean, and when I became president of Purdue University, because his style was so effective in motivating others, and it was something worth emulating, and I tried to do that, and I guess that's the highest compliment one can pay to a colleague, if mm-hmm. you want to be like that individual mm-hmm. and copy the style that he had. Walter Dolly, of course, a colleague and friend, and my immediate successor. Bob Holden, I engaged his services when he was at Vanderbilt and picked him out as a very young and eager, bright, motivated, principled, highly effective colleague in radiology, and we worked together at Wishart Hospital, which right. was a big challenge
right.
during my deanly years. And again, I could go on in every area here and tell you about the people that we have had here during these last 32 years that I've been privileged to be here, which is coincidentally a third of the entire right. history of the medical school.
Right.
So I'm beginning to feel old. But, one of the great things about modern medicine is that wherever you go to school nowadays, you're going to get approximately the same content. But what you can't get everywhere is that a cadre of committed and concerned and dedicated teachers who, like at Pittsburgh, work together mm-hmm. for the common good mm-hmm. and are role models for the younger ones coming along, be they students or younger colleagues, and who do such an exceptional job in caring for the patient. And it has been said that the secret of caring for the patient lies in caring for the patient. You have to be willing to care.
Right.
And we do that here extremely well. People come out of here and they're good doctors.
That's good, can I say. What was the status of the school when you arrived here?
Well, we had a very good school, but as most schools at that time, we were oriented to turning out general practitioners, which was true at Pittsburgh when I was a student. And we really were not emphasizing specialty medicine to the degree that we eventually evolved it, and that was necessary, of course, to do the kind of cutting-edge research and frontier work in all the various disciplines. We didn't have every discipline represented at first, and that began to grow. For example, we didn't have an endocrine unit, we didn't have a cancer unit, mm-hmm. rheumatology unit, we didn't have a diabetes center, mm-hmm. and on and on. Mm-hmm. So these were some of the things I was privileged to help with and to help bring about. Of course, we had very antiquated facilities.
Yes.
And during my time here, we built the University Hospital and the Riley Hospital and many, many laboratories, which are state of the art. We had on this medical center six hospitals which didn't talk to one another. The staffs were not integrated and coordinated. The Veterans Hospital staff was totally separate from the University Hospital group, and the Wishart Hospital, as we call it now, was a city-county hospital, a city hospital, and it again had a different staff than the rest of us. And one of the big challenges which I then worked at when I was dean was to bring all this together and coordinate and have a single staff, which I think was important then and is important mm-hmm. now in terms of making sure that not just the minimal standards of accreditation are met, but that the expectations in terms of quality are met. And that is guaranteed in large part by saying everyone has to be a faculty qualified person. And that's what we have now.
You mentioned City Hospital, which was Marion County General when you came here. I'd like for you to describe the steps that you took to bring Wishart into the fold and how that all came about.
Our first concern was the quality concern, that we wanted to be able to give our patients the same level of care by the same group of people across the medical center, be they in a psychiatric setting, at the state hospital, at the VA, at the city, Marion County General Hospital, at Riley, at University Hospital, and so on. The second concern was for our educational program. We wanted to make sure that our students had sufficient rotations available and that they were of equivalent worth and merit so that we could really field a coordinated and integrated educational program in all disciplines. The third concern was to save Marion County General Hospital.
Right.
And this was where we were deeply involved with the city because that hospital was always broke and running deficit budgets year after year, and the city was asked to bail it out year after year. And I thought that if we brought it into the group and if we extended the faculty into that hospital and if we attempted to through the Reagan Street Clinic, we had a wonderful relationship with Mr. and Mrs. Reagan Street, who funded the building and gave us operational money for the institute. If we could build a bridge and have the outpatient activities at the Reagan Street Health Center, and spill over with many of our specialties into not just the Reagan Street building, but into the Wishart Hospital. If we could affect a relationship with Eli Lilly and its research hospital, which has since moved out of there and is now in the University Hospital, that we could suffice all of these major issues, and we could even have enough paying patients in there and Medicare, Medicaid reimbursements and so on, so that we could relieve the city of the worry that this would be an annual deficit operation. Mm-hmm. And the steps we had to take were, first of all, to get everyone to think in those lines, and secondly, to work out legal agreements that would allow for this arrangement, with the facilities still being owned by the Health and Hospital Corporation, which is part of the city, but with the programs and the staff appointments all being the responsibility of the medical school. And then came the big one, which is again an issue now, as Clarion is trying to integrate the academic physicians with the practicing physicians, and that is, how do you turn on the people to view the same sets of goals and objectives that I've just alluded to, and to commit themselves to doing this kind of work. One of the problems we had, for example, was that private patients were offended by seeing prisoners of the Marion County Sheriff's Department in chains being brought in by vans and waiting in the emergency room and in the clinics for care while they were there. How do you handle that? Well, one of the things we did was to bring about an emergency trauma center there, which was the first level one center in the state, so that if you had a really serious problem, that's where you went. And pretty soon people recognized that the quality of care and the attention they were getting was the important part, and not who else might be sitting in the waiting room. I think we were able, by just sheer tenacity, to bring about a sea change in attitude, and that was really prerequisite to making it work, and I'm really pleased that it's still working today.
Yes, it's a major accomplishment. You also played a major role in implementing the statewide medical education system.
Right.
So I'd like you to discuss that, and then the lasting importance of the statewide medical education system to the school, to the university, to the state, and then medical education as a whole.
I'm glad you asked that. Glenn Irwin and George Lukemeyer, both dear friends and wonderful colleagues, had been here, of course, in executive capacities in the medical school when I came. And they brought me in, John Hickam and those two. And George had been in charge of continuing education statewide, and that's a job I inherited from him. And one of the things that he had done was to suggest that we have a coordinated graduate education program, that means internship residency type programs, throughout the state, and to affiliate the community hospitals. There were 26 of them that we eventually affiliated. And we talked about, because there was a push in the state with the doctor shortage we had at that time, having another medical school. We didn't think there were enough resources in the state, and that's still true, to have a second medical center and medical school of quality. And the proposal was made by George and by Glenn to evolve a statewide system which, beginning with continuing medical education and then internship residency programs in these 26 hospitals around the state, would superimpose on that, with the help of the major universities, a program for freshman medical students. A really revolutionary idea, because again, the stylized approach that our medical school accreditation organization has had for many, many years was that to make it reproducible quality, every school had to do it much the same way. There had to be certain laboratories of certain size and faculties of distinction, and I couldn't imagine doing this in an environment that was other than a major university medical center. And it was George's idea that we do this in the framework not just of these community hospitals, but of the Purdue's and the Notre Dame's of our state. And in